Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Slash Film Daily. Today is Monday, April 22nd, 2024. On today's episode of the show, I'm going to present a couple of interviews about Guy Ritchie's newest movie, The Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare. My name is Ben Pearson. I am an editor at slashfilm.com, and this is normally the part where I would talk with somebody about the movie for a few minutes, or at the very least, I would bring someone on who has seen the film and have them tell me all about it. Unfortunately, I did not have time to get out and see the movie, which debuted in theaters late last week. And we have a lot of editors and writers at Slash Film who are not working for a variety of reasons today, which has resulted in basically the perfect storm of circumstances that mean I cannot bring you a conversation about this movie. So I apologize for that. Hopefully, though, the length of the interviews will help make up for it. One of our writers, Jeremy Mathai, spoke with one of this film's screenwriters. His name is Arash Amel, for almost 20 minutes. And then separately, he spoke with one of the supporting actors, Babs Olusemokun. And that conversation lasted for about 15 minutes. So I'm just going to get out of the way and play these conversations for you. First up is Jeremy's interview with writer Arash Amel, whose credits include films like A Private War, Hidden Strike, and more.
So just to jump right to it, looking at your filmography to this point, I mean, you've had experience with period pieces, streaming exclusives, biopics, genre movies. You've even written a graphic novel of your own. Basically, you've had a whole broad range of, you know, experience on very different projects, even different mediums, and even in different roles as your work as a writer and producer. So all that leads to Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare. My question is kind of a broad one, but what brought you to this? What drew you to this project in particular over any other, besides the paycheck, of course?
Of course, it's never as big as you think. So in 2017, actually, I was involved. I got involved pretty early on in this project. The book, the wonderful book, historical nonfiction book written by Damian Lewis. So Jerry Bruckheimer had picked that up in 2015, and Paramount at that time, which was the studio, had acquired it. There was having some trouble figuring out the movie, and I was sent it in 2017 by Jerry with the thought of, "Hey, can you see a movie in this? Like, how do we do this?" And as you can imagine, a World War II movie, you know, that's not a superhero, it's not an existing IP, it's not a sequel, it's not. So there was a lot of ground to cover. And then I'd just done a movie called A Private War at that time, which is part of the reason, which was a true story that was adapted, and so it's very similar kind of DNA to this. And when I read it, I was immediately transported, this book, to the great war movies that I grew up with, but the movies of the 60s and 70s. So once we'd gotten far enough from World War II, that there was some kind of, you know, pop culture ownership of it, that sort of, you know, there was a re-examining. And so the works of John Sturges, so The Great Escape, even sort of the Western influences, like The Magnificent Seven, and then The Dirty Dozen, Kelly's Heroes, Where Eagles Dare. So all of these sort of great movies. And I thought, wow, this is such a high adventure, absurd, ridiculous sort of comedy almost kind of movie that, barring Quentin with Inglourious Basterds, you know, which is a very Quentin movie, like Hollywood hasn't made, and they don't make, and sort of in a long time. And it's such an important story. It's, you know, we're at the threat of actually forgetting how bad the Nazis were, and the threat of Nazism. And I feel sort of that for a new generation, we need to have this reminder. And also, it was an opportunity for us to have some fun with a piece of history that no one knows about. So when all of those things came together, I was like, I would love to jump into this. And I should say there was one other component.
Okay.
This was the first time that I'd ever read a World War II story where it was about a coming together, a coalition of different people from different walks of life, different cultures, different races, different ethnicities. In true, this in true story sort of fashion, the Number 62 Commando Unit, which is what this unit was called, was comprised of people from all over the world. You had people of many different nationalities. It relied on a very intricate network of African spies and Nigerian spies who all had this sort of collective interest in defeating the Nazis. And so for me, there had never been a World War II movie where you see sort of a collection of cultures coming together essentially and against a common enemy. And that's a very, I feel, 2024 story in terms of the world that we live in. So those were the kind of the genesis ideas that brought us to this point.
You've answered roughly five questions that I was going to ask you there. So that's going to be a very short interview. Great job. Great work.
I'm gonna
But
take myself out of airtime here.
I can tell you're a pro at this. But one of my follow-up questions I was going to ask, you kind of addressed it, but I was wondering whether the tone that Guy Ritchie brought to it, kind of an action comedy, as you mentioned, was that there in the script? Was that there in the book that you read? And clearly the answer is yes.
Yeah, so in the terms of the book, it was there in the story. So I'll give you one example. The beginning of the movie, I'm not giving anything away, it's in the trailers. You see sort of Henry as Gus Marge Phillips lead this raid on a Nazi camp and rescue Apple sort of and they massacre a lot of Nazis in the process. Now, that was actually a coming together of two operations that they did subsequently. Where there was something called Operation Dryden, where they did sort of sail this little boat called the Little Pisser to the cliff, and I mean in the names it tells you everything. Sort of into the to this cliff, scale the cliff, cut the wires, and then when they actually got inside the camp to steal some naval intelligence, in that case, the Nazis actually fainted. Sort of like two of them fainted, one of them was in a hairnet, like three of them gave up immediately. They were all so terrified. And it was a whole garrison and they took it without that much bloodshed. And so even though there was a subsequent mission where they did end up massacring a lot of Nazis, there was a lot of this like ridiculousness. It was, you know, just the ridiculousness of the conceit that you were losing to probably the most mechanized army that the history of the world has ever seen. And so you decide that you're going to sabotage them by a handful of men and women armed with bow and arrows and knives and new fighting techniques they'd found in sort of, you know, from Asia and India and and worked into this whole new kind of primitive way of fighting to kind of to cut through. There was an inherent comedy in it. And so my draft was actually, it was kind of, I would say more, it was sort of, it had humor and it had a lot of the elements that kind of ended up, you know, in the movie, kind of then blown up into Guy's tone there. But my first ever pitch to Paramount, who was the studio at the time, in 2017, when they said, like, what do you think this movie? I said, in the worst Hollywood way imaginable, I said, The Dirty Dozen meets Ocean's 11, directed by Guy Ritchie. That was the original pitch a few years before Guy eventually got the script and said, oh, okay. This seems it's kind of written for me, so I'll go do my thing. And then obviously from there, it kind of Guy does his thing so well in terms of, you know, that he's a genre unto himself, and I don't think you can say that about many filmmakers.
Now, did you when you were writing your draft, were you writing with specific actors in mind? Because, watching a movie, you can't imagine anyone but Henry Cavill, right, and his role, and especially Alan Ritchson in his role. So I'm curious, just like how is, writing the dialogue, their mannerisms, how did that process work out for you?
So it's an alchemy. You never, and I certainly never write with an actor in mind because the beauty of it is in the surprise. And so you have to always be open and you have to be true to the character. You have the qualities of who the character is. And a lot of the casting actually reflected the characters who they were. And I can't imagine anyone but Henry playing Gus. I can't imagine anyone but Carrie playing M or Freddie playing Ian Fleming. Like it's that they're also, you know, so there. But I'll tell you a little interesting sort of nugget is that how you can leave yourself open to be surprised. Because in the original script in the original draft, and even as we were kind of progressing, and you know, as Guy was progressing in his sort of subsequent drafts in pre-production. The character of Lassen that Alan Ritson played in real life is not was it certainly was not written as, you know, a hulking sort of sledgehammer, even though in real life Anders Lassen was that in spirit. Everything you see with the bow and arrow, the way he kills Nazis, his ferocity, his hatred, all of that was very true. He ended up becoming this godfather of the modern SAS. But he was a tall guy, but he wasn't a big guy. He was, you know, and you see pictures of him. And so in the script, what I'd done was Lassen was in the way that he was kind of slightly more historically. And then there was another character who was a composite called Hazy that was a big Irish guard that had joined, and just as a nod to the Irish guard that were in the in the commander unit. But when casting came around, those two roles swapped.
Okay.
So the character the hero plays, Hazy, is obviously now Gus's protege, and he's a much more sort of you know, quieter, circumspect, but very effective operative. And then we have Alan. And Alan was like the secret weapon. And, you know, and Alan spoken very eloquently on sort of, you know, the ferocity that he wanted to bring to the role. But, you know, they called Anders Lassen the Viking. And I think in a movie, the only way you can have the only Viking you can have is Alan. So that's kind of just a little peek into the into how that alchemy works, and you can't control it too much.
I love that. It's, you know, everything's a collaboration, but you also can't expect, you know, you can't predict everything that's going to happen. My next question is, you know, with a story like this, you know, obviously there's attention to historical detail, there's accuracy that matters. How do you balance that between just telling, you know, an entertaining, dramatic story?
So when I started, my first North Star was that this can't ever become a history lesson. This has to be a fun movie. It has to be something that all the messages has to be through osmosis. You have to come in, you have to be sort of entertained. And I've done a few true life adaptations now, and one of the elements that has become very clear to me is this process that truth can often be the enemy of good drama, and so you have to be willing to composite and change and bring things around. However, if you stray too much from the truth, you can also sacrifice the meaning and the essence of the story in the first place. So you can't fictionalize too much. So when I come to adapting anything, everything has to be rooted in something truthful. It may have happened later. It might be an essence of a character. It might be five characters put together, but ultimately, it has to be something that you can trace back to. No, something like this kind of happened, and we're sort of, you know, interpreting it, and it is artistic interpretation. So that's the kind of the process. And for me, I was operating by these rules with the one overarching rule of don't forget to have fun. And that was it.
Now, with a movie like this, you know, there's multiple writers credited to this screenplay and all that. Do you know, you've been at this for a while. You know exactly, you know, with the WGA, all the credits and all the stuff that goes into it. Do you write with the assumption or, you know, the understanding that, you know, parts of your script will end up being rewritten down the line as, you know, Guy Ritchie sees fit as other writers down the line? Or like, how does that work on your end?
You can, again, you can never think about that. You just have to write the best movie you can in the way you can't, you know, I respect all writers. You know, I've been on WGA committees myself. It's something that I feel is really important. Writers are often forgotten. And on this, you know, there's Eric and Paul who actually found the book, and they found the book with Jerry, and they worked with the studio initially to try and find a path into what kind of movie it is. And sometimes that just doesn't work out, and you know it's kind of timing. And I've certainly been in their position, where you try to sort of come up with a movie, and you it just isn't there, and then it goes to someone, and they go, oh, you know what? This is the story I've been waiting to tell my whole life. And so that's a process, and you go through these sort of, you know, sort of arbitration and sort of things like that. And there was none of that here in terms of any sort of friction or any. And they were terrific about the whole thing. And with me handing the script over to Guy, I knew very much that, like I said, my first pitch was this was going to be a Guy Ritchie movie. So I, knew where this would eventually, hopefully, in my fantasy casting, would end up. And so one of the things that, I did was to make sure that, the essence was there, so that the structure was there, the tone kind of was there, that it could then be elevated and lifted, that the characters allowed for playfulness and fun and so on. And then the rest of it kind of becomes a sandbox, because the guy has a very unique way of working, which is often very improvised. It's kind of just looking at, okay, we know what the essence of the scene is, but okay, oh, Isaac, can you sing? Oh, you can sing. Okay, let's do a song. And there was no song in the original, in my script, in the original draft that I had a guy, but that came up during production. And oh, can you sing in German? Let's sing, let's do this in German. And she acquitted herself so incredibly well. And and I'd be sort of getting messages from set, from the producers saying, oh, so now we have a song and now it's in German. So, but it's all in keeping with the spirit. And if you've done your job as a writer, and you give it to such, consummate kind of craftsmen and talented actors, then it's you feel you're in safe hands.
Now, you mentioned A Private War earlier, and that's a movie I really, really love.
Thank you.
And so I was wondering, obviously that did play a role in, you finding your way to this project in particular, but was there anything that you could look back to, lessons learned or anything along those lines when you were adapting from that? Obviously that was a nonfiction story as well that you were turning into a movie. Was there anything that you kind of rely on when you came to writing the script on Gentlemanly Warfare?
So it's interesting, because A Private War was actually a really enjoyable and fruitful experience, much like this one, in that I learned way back when on a movie called Grace of Monaco, which was my first foray into adapting something that was based on a true story. And I learned so many things, because that was what I call sort of this beautiful disaster where, everything that could have gone right went wrong. And, it was a very public kind of, airing of dirty laundry. But what I learned was that you have to respect your subject, and you have to, at the same time, respect the movie that you're trying to write, and you have to always be cognitive to balance that. And that should also go hand in hand with the second thing that I learned, was that you have to choose your partners very carefully. Like the ultimately, in terms of the producers that you work with and the directors that you work with, because they have so much bearing on the material. And so it's very important to find people who kind of adhere to the same values as you, and so that's how you avoid the conflict and the, well, I want it to be this movie and I want it to be that movie, and you're all kind of making the same movie. And A Private War was the first time that that really came together, and Matt Heineman, who directed it, did an incredible job. And I thought, Rosamund, if you, in terms of the question that you asked about who do you imagine playing this role, I mean, who did I imagine playing Marie Colvin? And at a time, it was briefly, it was going to be sort of Charlize. And when I and when that sort of didn't pan out, it was like, well, who is it going to be? And then Rosamund comes in and just takes it to a place where you go, my God, like, you're the real person. So a lot of the sort of best experiences were, that it all came together, and it was on A Private War, and this movie benefited from that.
My final question for you. I mean, I could go on all day, but I'll cut you short. Don't worry.
Sure, no worries.
Have you seen Alex Garland's Civil War yet?
I have not.
Okay.
I'm I was hoping to go this weekend, but we have our premiere this weekend,
Right.
so we're kind of, competing at the box office. So that's, no, I have not. But what's your question?
I bring that up because watching that, and I'm assuming at least a general idea of what that movie's about, wartime, focus on, war journalists particularly. It did remind me so much of A Private War while I was watching it. And, both of them feel very complementary to each other. I just wanted to bring that up. That way it's just serendipitous that I ended up talking to you this week.
Oh, thank you so much. Yeah, no, I'm very excited about it. I was reading, where was it? There was some of the reviews yesterday. I think the Washington Post did a really great review on it, where they talked about sort of the perils of war photojournalism and war photography. And ironically, Paul Conroy, who Jamie Dornan played in the movie, sort of the most wonderful man, like Paul is sort of a true living hero. He's just come back from Ukraine, so he's just, they've been there for like 6 months and really living it. And so yeah, when I saw that, to some of the commentary on Civil War, it was very much an echo of it. I mean, it's still with us. I mean, that's notion of war hasn't gone away. I mean, we're right in the middle of seeing, two very disastrous wars concurrently. And I think the role of sort of war photojournalists, war journalists, is more important than ever before. So I'm very happy that Alex made the movie and has kept that message very much alive.
Thank you so much for your time today, Rosh. I really enjoyed this. This is fantastic.
Thank you so much, Jeremy. Pleasure's all mine.
Jeremy also had the opportunity to speak with Babs Olusanmokun, who worked with Guy Ritchie previously on a movie called Wrath of Man, which I really liked a lot. And I suspect most people might recognize him as playing Dr. M'Benga on Star Trek Strange New Worlds, or he also played Jamis in Denis Villeneuve's Dune. So here is Jeremy's conversation with Babs.
Thank you, Babs, for taking the time to do this with me today.
Thank you for having me, Jeremy.
So this is the second time you've worked with Guy Ritchie. I have to ask, what's from your point of view, what's the main appeal of working with him?
He's an auteur. He's a fantastic filmmaker. He's Guy Ritchie. That's the main appeal. He's done films that many, many actors wish they could have been in. So that's really it for actors. When you see a filmmaker that knows how to put a film together, where the actors look like they're having fun, memorable characters, it's the appeal, I think, will always be, So, yeah, so it's very cool.
Is this a case where you have to read the script first, or is it just, he calls you and you answer and you say yes, no questions asked?
I mean, yeah, pretty much. You want to say yes, no questions asked. Live without the qu any questions being. You don't ask any questions. You're just like, yeah. I did a film called Wrath of Man with him, and this came around, and it was just put right in front of me. And yes, I'll see you there, guy. So that's a privilege in itself. So, yeah.
In general, how does a Guy Ritchie production compare to, say, some other directors you've worked with in the past, like Denis Villeneuve or anything like
Say
that?
that again, please. Say that again, please.
Compared to other directors you've worked with in the past, how
Yeah.
does being on a Guy Ritchie production compare?
I mean, Guy goes, there are different levels of spontaneity in within the work, and film and with Guy, there's preparation behind the scenes, but then really when it comes to the dialogue, Guy is very particular in terms of seeing things in a different light on the day, on the morning. And on that morning, he is loose, and yet he gets very specific, with within almost like your workshop in the morning of a shooting day. And he's very excited and conductor-like, and you get it done. Other directors have they come with that plan because maybe they've done the workshop in before and whatnot, and it's just different sensibilities. But fantastic directors end up with engaging work. They might one might go like this, one might go like that, but at the end of the day, they come up with something compelling to watch, and that's what Guy has done with the Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare.
So, as a big fan of World War II movies personally, I was struck by the presence of yourself, Isaac Gonzalez, Henry Golding in this movie. This genre is usually only ever told from kind of a white person's perspective. So, as one person of color to another, was that something that you were thinking about when you joined this project?
Absolutely, absolutely. But the reality is, those things were always were always done. World War II, World War I, these battles were fought with Africans on the French side for World War I. For World War II, you had people from all over. You had African support in different capacity. You had people from India supporting the British Empire, for World War I too. Like, it's so knowing that history, I get less of it is only those who are not aware and who are sort of ignorant to their history, unfortunately for them, because it's not really spoken and told. And so people from from the rest of the world essentially contribute to things without being given, I don't want to say the due or the credit for what they had to sacrifice for these, for these endeavors that nobody really should be proud of. I don't really care that, one could participate in World War II or World War I and, God forbid, World War III, and, we don't want any parts of it in reality. But yes, the palette of history is with so many from all parts of the world, and if you're lucky enough to be properly educated, and I mean properly educated, I don't, as in knowing true history, you'll realize so many people from different cultures and faraway places sacrificed their lives for these moments in history.
Thank you for that. A movie like this is clearly wearing, a lot of its influences on its sleeve. Like a lot of your portions with Isaac Gonzalez is kind of like taking almost a riff on Casablanca and stuff like that. Was that apparent from reading the script, or was that more of a thing where you got on set, on location, and you're like, wow, this is the kind of movie we're in right now?
No, absolutely. As a student of film, I was aware of that connection and I embraced it because Casablanca is a classic, film. And I think in film and within work artistically, one always references and is inspired by the past and past works. And then it's simply about doing justice to those past works, And so for me, I embraced that idea and I thought it was a beautiful, sexy thing to play and to be, and to have my version of Rick. And just, a wonderful responsibility as an actor to be put in that position and truly enjoyed it. Truly enjoyed it. It was so fun.
Now, it kind of sounds funny saying this out loud, but watching the movie, it's like it just feels so refreshing to know that, okay, you guys actually, the crew actually built sets, you went on location, the costume department went above and beyond. It just felt like a throwback to the way movies used to be made decades ago. How did you feel about that? Was that something that you noticed too?
Absolutely, absolutely. In our work, you're playing. That's all it is, as an actor, to play, to, and Guy, the director, plays in his own way. I see it in his eyes. I see it in his way. He's playing, and so we get to play these roles and to be able to do it at a harbor that was built specifically for the film is, what that says is so much work was done before I even showed up on set, right? And so I always tip my hat, to the production artists, the location people, people that went from one country to another to search for this area, and say, this is the perfect spot. It's painstaking work, filmmaking. And so I'm always appreciative of all the different parts that come together to make it. And yeah, the wardrobe, you're in 40s garb, I'd come on set and Guy would like come up to me. It's like, my God, Babs, like, and he's literally making a note like, hey, costume, I've got to have this when this film is done, So yeah, to be able to play is just and be paid for it is such a beautiful, beautiful experience. And that's what we did. We different locations, on set, and yeah, just to make something grounded, something fun yet grounded and real and just big, cinematic. It was a cinematic experience, and I'm quite certain the audiences will find the same.
Now, I don't know how often this will come up today with some other interviews you're doing, but
How much what, Jeremy?
I don't know how much this will come up today in your other interviews today, but you're kind of an expert martial artist yourself. You know, you have that background, black belt, jiu-jitsu, all that. I know you had your big fight scene in Dune a couple years back, but I'm wondering, were you ever pushing Guy like to get yourself into the action, kind of let you show off the skills that you have?
No, you know, it's really funny because it is only now that in my head I can meld the two. I was an actor first. I've always loved martial arts as a kid, but I never saw it alongside my work as an actor.
Interesting.
What I'm pulled towards in terms of acting is very much more the drama, you know. It's not going up on screen and beating up people. That's never really how, you know, working and growing up in New York City and studying, you know, acting and whatnot. I never, in my mind, I never saw myself in that direction. It was very much about the work, you know, and the masters of cinema and the great actors. And this is really truly what I've always pursued. So the action thing and the fighting thing is something people get excited about once they find out that I do that. But personally, for me, to do action on screen, I want it to be at the highest level. I'm not interested in like, oh, I punched five guys, 10 guys, and you know, if I could do action with really fantastic directors that know how to do it, and for this film with Guy, maybe it wasn't the place. There are other guys doing stuff, but at one point in time, we'll come up with something sexy, where I'm doing the action.
Looking forward to that for sure. Now, another like I'm kind of wondering, with a movie like this, you know, the great cast that it has and all that sort of stuff, is it ever overwhelming to be on set with it all, you know, all this stuff going on and that sort of thing? And you know, this is based on a book, it's based on history and that sort of thing. Do these pressures ever come up in your mind or anything like that when you're actually doing your part?
I mean, lucky for me, the only responsibility I have is for the character, you know, that I saw on the page, you know, and then building daily off of that, you know, with Guy's direction and building something truthful and substantial. You know, the other things, other people have responsibilities for those things, and you also just have to trust that responsibility or that sense of responsibility is within everybody else you're working with. And luckily, I believe that's the case with this film. And then you come together to create this thing and mold this thing and hopefully come up with something engaging and compelling. And yeah, so responsibility, yes. And again, thankfulness that I get to play in this sandbox, really.
Now, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that my colleagues at Slash Film, me included, we're all huge Star Trek fans. We love your work in Strange New Worlds.
Thank you.
Between you and me and all of our readers, I'm wondering, what do you prefer? You know, acting as the kindest, most compassionate Dr. Mbenga on Star Trek, or kind of getting your hands dirty a little bit with a roguish type kind of character on a Guy Ritchie movie?
I think they both have something. I think if you do it with a certain level of truth, you know, like whatever I do, I try to bring from deep within. So whether it's the roguish or it's the, you know, compassionate and whatnot, it comes from deep within and therefore worthy. So they both will do something and give me something. If you allow me to play that, I love both paths.
Now, my final question for you is another Star Trek related one. I know you're probably in the middle of, you know, shooting season three at the moment, but
Yes,
so I have
I am.
a general question then, since I'm sure you can't really talk about much, but did you ever watch Dr. Mbenga's episodes from the original series to see, you know, how the character was played before, and did you kind of hone your performance for that, or did you feel like you had the room to reinvent him a little bit more and make it your own?
Well, I did simply because, you know, it had been done. It was just two episodes of Dr. Mbenga in the past, if I'm not mistaken. It couldn't have been more than three. So it was easier to watch and just see. But I don't know that if it was If it had been across a few seasons, I might have stayed away, or I might have just watched a bit and then left it, because as respectful and appreciative of the past as you want to be, you also have to give yourself room to build something new, you know? So I could watch those because it was, again, I think 2 episodes, and then there's a nod to that, you know, great start, and then just hopefully forge something new for those, you know, that would be watching. And that's been the journey so far, and hopefully I am getting close to giving something worthy.
Well, thank you again for your time today, Babs. It was really nice meeting you. Very nice talking with you.
Pleasure, Jeremy. Thank you so much. And thank everybody at Slash.
I will. Thank you so much. Take care.
All right, that's going to do it for today's episode of the show. You can find more about the Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare at slashfilm.com. I will try to link to a couple things in the show notes as well. Slash Film Daily is typically published every weekday, bringing you the most exciting news from the world of movies and TV, as well as deeper dives into the great features you can find on the site. You can subscribe to the show on Apple, Overcast, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Send your feedback, questions, comments, concerns, and mailbag topics to us at bpearson@slashfilm.com. Make sure to leave your name and general geographic location in case we mention your email on the air. Don't forget to take a minute to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. That really does help us out a lot. Tell your friends about this show any way you can. Thank you so much for listening, and we will talk to you all tomorrow.